mobile health with smartphones, hurricane nurses, pregnancy, flu, and autism. Plus, we're going to take a look at antihypertensive medications this week. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, and I'd like to welcome all of you to this week's program. We have a great show coming up for you this week, including a look at some of the nursing response to the hurricane and accounts of some of the evacuations that had to happen, all of that coming up in the news items. And we're also going to take a look at part one of our look at antihypertensive medications. So stay tuned for that later on in this episode. If you want to follow up on any of the information, of course, I urge you to do so. You can find links to everything we talk about, the news items, links to additional resources having to do with the tip of the week. All of that is available for you over at the Nursing Show website. You can find that at nursingshow.com. If you want to get back in touch with me, I welcome you to do that as well. Please do so. I love to hear from the audience, and I do respond back to every single email that comes in. So keep them coming. Send those emails in here to nursingshow@gmail.com, and I'll look forward to hearing from you. Without too much further ado, we're going to get ready to get into this week's news. We'll kick off this week's news items with a look at a report coming out of the Pew Internet and American Life Project, and they look at how Americans use the internet in their daily lives and everyday things, in mundane things, and accessing the internet for things like recipes, information about a variety of things. In this particular case, looking at accessing the internet for healthcare information. And one of the things that they found was that about 52% of smartphone users use their smartphones to access information for health content. So that could be even while they're in the doctor's office awaiting information from the doctor or waiting to be seen. They could be looking up information about their health, following up on their symptoms, or they could even be doing this at home, which points out exactly why we need to be very proactive with our patients about encouraging them to find high quality resources for healthcare information. I think it's important for all healthcare professionals and organizations to have a list of trusted links, sites that people can go to get follow-up and additional information. Sites like the National Library for Medicine that is available over at the National Institutes of Health website. Information from the CDC, the FDA. Trusted resources in the educational community, other medical schools, and other trusted information. By curating that information for your patients and pointing them to your own website, saying, here are some additional links you can follow up on, you will empower them to be more informed about whatever's going on in their health, and they'll be able to ask you better questions about what they should be doing, and perhaps pick up on something you didn't pick up on and bring it up at their next visit. All of that is important because we need to continue fostering this sense of healthcare partnership with patients, that we have the healthcare team that is working with them, the nurses, the physicians, nurse practitioners, pharmacists, and all of the people involved in the patient's healthcare team, both in a hospital and outside of the hospital. Then the patient becomes an integral part of that team as well. And you're going to find that this is much better. The patient who is informed, who is able to make conscious decisions about what's going on, who's able to ask intelligent questions about their health, makes for a better interaction and a better outcome for those patients. So this is exciting. One of the things they say is that women between the ages of 30 and 64 are likely to sign up for health text alerts, and cell phone owners with a college degree or those owners between the ages of 18 and 49 are more likely to gather information on their health devices. And I think that's a social graph look at who's owning those smartphones. But 85% of all U.S. adults own cell phones at this point, and a lot of them are smartphones. So we should be encouraging our patients to access trusted health apps, for instance. If you have a diabetes patient, have you looked into the variety of diabetes management apps that are out there? Do you have one you recommend to them, or several that you recommend they try, and give them an opportunity to find the one that best fits their style of diabetes management? All of these things are important parts of the process, and I hope you will continue to look at ways to engage actively with your patients in the ways they want to be engaged. If you're like me, you are really affected by seeing the devastation caused by Hurricane Sandy. It's very reminiscent of the type of devastation seen with Hurricane Katrina, Hurricane Andrew, and other major weather events here in the United States. And I think it's important to also note that there have been a lot of positive things that have happened during this event. A lot of people stepped up and raised the bar for what they expected of themselves and of others around them. But, you know, one group of people that often gets overlooked and often are the unsung heroes in events like this are nurses. And I found a great article looking at how nurses were integral in the response, in the evacuations, and in the follow-up care involved with Hurricane Sandy. So we're going to be looking at that over the coming weeks, and I have several articles picked out over the coming weeks that will look at different aspects of how the nurses take care of their patients in different ways. One of the things is, if you were following the news at all, you know that several New York hospitals had their power generators fail. So the power went out in the power grid, and then their generators kicked on, and for whatever reason, their generators failed. A lot of times because their generators or their fuel supplies were in the basement or in low-lying areas, and when those basement or low-lying areas flooded around the hospital, their generators failed. Something to think about for the future, folks. But one of the things that's very interesting is that there are some amazing stories of heroism and of just persevering through very adverse conditions to make sure that patient care was not affected. And if any of you have seen the pictures coming out of the coverage of the nurses working as teams to bring neonatal or NICU infants down the steps because they couldn't take the elevators from the NICU unit in this New York hospital, on manual resuscitators, carrying all of the monitors and equipment needed to take care of these infants, carrying them down the steps and getting them transported to other hospital NICU units, really points out the amazing efforts taken to ensure high quality patient care by these nurses. One of the things I found out in this article I linked to this week is that the timing of Hurricane Sandy actually was beneficial. Now, a lot of people say, but wait, it came at high tide, and that's what made it worse. Well, it also came, coincidentally, at shift change for several hospitals. And so they actually had twice the amount of nurses in the hospitals when the power failed. And they were able to, and of course, that means nurses, that means shift change for a lot of other staffing members as well. And so they were very well staffed to handle evacuations and patient care emergencies. And so this was fortuitous. This was a lucky thing to have happen, that it just so happened that the flooding and the power outages occurred at a time when staff was switching over and there were more nurses available for care, and so they were able to really team up to get this job done. There's a lot more to this article, and I really urge you to head over to nursingshow.com and check out the information in this article. It covers the nurses in this particular hospital with the neonatal patients, as well as other nurses involved in the response and exactly what they did and how they were recognized after the fact. And I hope you will check out this article over there. You know, I've talked a lot here over the past few years about the spurious links from autism to various things in the environment and the links that have said that vaccines had some causative factor or other problems. Of course, these things have been disproven. I want to make sure that it's very clear. I know all of you know that there is no link between vaccines and autism. But one of the things to come out of this intense look at autism recently, in recent years, is that there have been a lot of studies looking at exactly what is causing autism, what factors are causing patients to present with the autism spectrum disorders. And one of the correlations that has been discovered, and again, there's going to be a lot more that has to go into this, but one of the correlations seems to be related to high fever, prolonged high fever in women during pregnancy, and particularly influenza. So if you were pregnant during flu season and you contracted the seasonal flu and you went through that process of going through the flu while you were pregnant with a sustained fever over time, that could be an affecting factor causing autism spectrum disorder. Now, certainly it's not the only factor, and everything that we've discovered and seen about autism points to a variety of environmental and genetic factors that add up to a child presenting with autism spectrum disorder. But this particular study does point out, and they looked at a cohort of nearly 100,000 children in Denmark, and they talked to the mothers and asked them about illnesses during pregnancy. The following illnesses during pregnancy were found not to have any correlation. So there is no correlation between respiratory infections, just general respiratory infection, urinary tract infections, genital infections, colds, or sinus infections. This is particularly related to influenza, the seasonal flu, fever, and in some cases there seemed to be a slightly higher risk when taking antibiotics. So we need to do more study on this, but I just wanted to point out that we are trying to crack this code and figure out what is causing autism. And it seems that there are a lot of factors involved, but this may be an indicator of some of the things to watch out for. And maybe we can be better, more proactive about managing high fever in our patients who are pregnant and managing them in such a way that they don't have prolonged high fever. We need to encourage them to get flu vaccines, right? So that they don't get the seasonal flu, or if they do, they get a milder version of it. All of these things are preventative factors that we can try to apply based upon some of this research and encourage our patients to avoid a potential family-changing disorder showing up in their new child. Coming up next in this episode is a look at antihypertensive medications. This will be part one of two segments that we look at over the next few weeks. And without too much further ado, let's get into looking at antihypertensive medications. Let's jump on into our tip of the week now, and we're going to talk about antihypertensive medications. This is a broad category of medications. We've covered the individual components of some of these drug classes in the past, beta blockers and ACE inhibitors and calcium channel blockers. But I wanted to give you a little bit different take on antihypertensive medications this week to kind of bring it around and have us look at it from the physiological standpoint. I think sometimes we get so locked into trying to understand different drug classes that we forget that these medications act on an individual and have physiologic effects. And if you can get a handle on some of those physiologic effects, sometimes you have a better understanding of what to expect from the standpoint of side effects, how to help the patient with dealing with some of those side effects so that they can remain on their medications, because, of course, compliance is a huge issue with patients that are taking antihypertensives. So let's talk a little bit about antihypertensive medications. We're going to start off with looking at the physiology of blood pressure, because that's going to be our primary focus this week. I also will be looking at them from the medications that primarily have cardiac effects, medications that primarily have vascular effects, and medications that affect fluid balance. We'll also, of course, cover nursing considerations associated with these and other medications, just to give you all some follow-up information. And, of course, additional resource links will be available in the show notes, and I urge you to follow up on those. Let's talk a little bit about the physiology of blood pressure first. Blood pressure in our bodies is managed by a variety of means. There are various ways we manage our blood pressure from minute to minute and hour to hour. There are short acting responses in the body, our sympathetic response. And so that's our first line of defense to maintain blood pressure. There are sympathetic and parasympathetic tension. These are antagonistic systems, and so they are constantly pushing and pulling against each other to maintain that homeostatic balance. There's also the renin cycle. This is kind of the midterm balancing method. And so over hours or days, the renin cycle will balance out the blood pressure in our bodies by using primarily an endocrine response to manage blood pressure over time. And general hydration, we shouldn't discount the value of making sure our patients are maintaining good hydration, making sure they're getting adequate fluids. Because so many of the patients that are taking antihypertensives are elderly patients, they have a difficult time maintaining fluid balance anyway. And when we add things to their systems that mess up their fluid balance, it's really important for us to make sure that they are maintaining adequate fluid intake. And so if you're in a facility, of course, managing and monitoring eyes and O's are very important. But what do we do to help our patients understand the importance of keeping an eye on those things when they're at home? So I think that we can do a better job of that as well. We'll talk about that briefly in nursing considerations. Let's start off with the parasympathetic and sympathetic tension when we talk about the tension between these two systems. You know, it's easy to remember these systems. Sympathetic, the fight or flight response. Parasympathetic, sometimes called the feed or breed response. One speeds us up and gets us ready to fight or run for our lives. Another one slows us down so that we can relax and digest and do whatever else comes to mind. So that's how we can try to maintain understanding and balance. We need to sometimes in our day-to-day rat race lives, we get ourselves so ramped up with tension and pressure that we put ourselves in a situation where we have an unusually heightened sympathetic response going on for a long period of time. And that heightened sympathetic response can cause us to have some situations going on where we have an abnormally high blood pressure. So let's keep that in mind. The sympathetic nervous system has both beta and alpha adrenergic effects. The beta effects are separated into beta 1, beta 2. Beta 2 primarily respiratory based, beta 1 primarily cardiac based. The alpha adrenergic effects are isolated primarily in the periphery. So you see alpha effects from the vasculature, the peripheral constriction of blood vessels you see in the sympathetic nervous system response. So if we're going to affect the system, we want to do something to affect some of those adrenergic effects, the beta and alpha effects. Also, this manages heart rate, so chronotropic response. Beta and alpha effects also manage cardiac contractility, the inotropic effects, and vascular tone. We also want to look a little bit at the renin cycle. Now, I could do a whole couple of shows on the renin cycle. This is a long and drawn-out process. There's lots of steps along the way. The advantage of this system is that because there's so many steps along the way, there are many places for medications to insert themselves and stop the process. And so there are a lot of newer medications that are coming out on the marketplace that are blocking the renin cycle, the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone cycle, somewhere along this pathway. Angiotensinogen is produced by the liver and is maintained in the bloodstream. Just kind of floats around out there, doesn't do anything, just kind of hangs out until renin is released by the kidneys. What happens is the kidneys sense a drop in blood pressure, the drop in fluid level, and the renin is released into the system. Renin heads out and causes angiotensin, is released. Causes angiotensinogen to convert to angiotensin 1, and angiotensin converting enzyme shows up in the system and converts that to angiotensin 2, and angiotensin 2 causes various effects to happen, including increased sympathetic tone, vasoconstriction along the periphery, releases aldosterone from the adrenal gland, and causes
ADH to also be released. So we have a variety of effects that all cause us to retain fluid. The aldosterone goes into work in the kidneys, causing us to hold on to sodium. When we hold on to sodium, we also hold on to water, because remember, water follows salt. Unfortunately, when we hold on to sodium, other things happen. We hold on to too much sodium, we tend to blow off or get rid of potassium. So we end up with potassium deficiencies potentially. If you couple a medication that affects this part of the cycle along with a potassium depleting diuretic, you could have a patient with a severe potassium deficiency. So you can see how these things can cascade very quickly. But this is basically the run-in cycle. I have a great link in the show notes to a Wikipedia page. Wikipedia, run away. No, I'll tell you what, there is some good information over at Wikipedia. The reason I like this particular Wikipedia entry is there is a fantastic graphical representation of the run-in cycle. So if you are trying to get a better handle on the renin angiotensin aldosterone cycle and how it works and what it affects, I would urge you to head over and check that link out. It's in the show notes. You should follow up on that and see how this graphic kind of lays out the system in a very nice picture, showing you how everything affects everything else. So, you know, there are some good stuff at Wikipedia. You have to check your resources. You have to have your knowledge base in place to make sure it's a good place to start. But definitely in this case, I think it's a pretty decent resource, at least to give you a quick review of this process. So let's talk about the cardiac targeted meds. Now remember, we're not going to talk about the individual medication classes so much. If you want that, we have other episodes here in the nursing show that do that. I want to talk a little bit about the different effects and where they target. So if a patient has a pretty good cardiac system, you know, they don't have an existing heart rate problem, they don't have an existing necessarily cardiac issue, it might be appropriate to reduce their heart rate and do some things to manage cardiac to manage the cardiac output. So a lot of times the old standard is a beta blocker. I call this the texting drug because it almost always ends in LOL. So I just kind of keep that in my mind to help me remember which medications are usually, not always, but usually beta blockers. So you have your beta blocker, your LOL drugs. You have your calcium channel blockers. Now beta blockers do what they say. They block the beta effects, the beta adrenergic effects, so that you end up slowing down the heart rate. You reduce that chronotropic effect, so you slow down the heart rate. You reduce that dromotropic or inotropic effect, so you slow down the contractility. And all of these things reduce cardiac output. You have less pushing out. You have less blood pressure. Calcium channel blockers, or the ENES, I-N-E-S, usually are an ending for the calcium channel blockers, you will see calcium channel blockers affecting the actual calcium channels in the myocardium. And what they do is they actually reduce that after squeeze, that little extra squeeze that comes to really force all the blood out of the heart, that give that full output of the cardiac muscle. The calcium channel blockers help to slow that down a little bit, and so we don't get as strong of a squeeze at the very end. And again, that also reduces cardiac output and will slow down the cardiac response, and we won't have as high a blood pressure. We have some central and peripheral alpha blockers. These will be working both in the cardiac channel, but also, again, we'll see in a little bit here in the vascular arena as well, causing peripheral vasoconstriction. And these all work together to basically reduce heart rate, reduce contractility. The problem is, of course, if a patient takes too much of these medications, if something throws their medication balance out of whack, you're going to have a patient who's going to have severe bradycardia occur or hypotension as a result of reduced contractility of the heart, reduced heart rate. And these patients need to be monitored carefully and need to be aware of some changes in the way they rise from bed in the morning, the way they get up when they've been sitting for a long period of time, all of those little tricks that we need to teach our patients in the educational process to help them manage these medications a little bit better.
And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I want to thank all of you for checking out the program this week and remind you to follow up on the additional information available for you over at The Nursing Show website. You'll find that at nursingshow.com. When you get over there, you'll see a show notes link at the top of the page. You can click that link and it will take you to a listing of all of the episodes. The most recent episode will show up first, and you can scroll down and find all of the previous episodes there. So if you're looking for something in particular, but there are links to all of the news items discussed in each episode, as well as additional resource links for the tip of the week or perhaps for an interview segment that occurred during that week's episode. If you want to get back in touch with me, I urge you to do so. I love to hear from you. You can reach me here by sending those emails in to nursingshow@gmail.com. I welcome your emails, and I do respond back to every email that comes in, so please keep those emails coming. If you want to follow up with me on Twitter or Facebook or any other social media site, you can generally find me under the handle PodMedic, and you can find me there, of course, twitter.com/PodMedic or facebook.com/PodMedic. And don't forget the Nursing Show fan page on Facebook. Growing as rapidly as a lot of the audience in the Nursing Show community is, and you can find that over at facebook.com/nursingshow. Go ahead and click the like button right there near the top of the page and become an official fan of the Nursing Show on Facebook. I post other links to articles and additional resource questions and things like that over there for the Nursing Show community on Facebook. So you want to become part of that, definitely follow up on that. And don't be shy. Leave a comment. Click the like button on an article that you see there. It really helps to spread the word about the Nursing Show, and it's one of those things you can do to help serve the Nursing Show community. That's it for me. I'll go ahead and close out the show and remind you, I'm Jamie Davis, your host here at the Nursing Show. If you want to catch more, we'll have a new episode coming out every Friday. And in the meantime, please remember, stay safe and stay tuned here to the Nursing Show. Take care.